Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
It belongs to me. Get off my world. It's paying.
Get off my world.
Get off my world. If you don't, you're gonna get it.
Get off my world.
Get off my world, or I'm gonna bury you in it.
Hi there. I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
And this is Get Off My World, a podcast about Doctor Who. We're three middle-aged guys who love the classic Doctor Who series and tolerate the recent version. So we're going to take you through five rounds rapid and tell you what we like, what we don't like very much about our favorite show. Now, we always start each episode with a round we call Temporal Grace, where we express something that we love about Doctor Who or the universe of Doctor Who. So, Kelvin, would you like to start us this week?
Yes. Titan Comics is going to be coming out with a Four Doctors story, and it's going to be the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th Doctors teaming up against the Cybermen, and I can't remember the name.
Supremacy of the Cybermen,
because it's the 50th anniversary of the Cybermen.
Nice.
And I think it's kind of cool that they actually got 9 in there.
Cool.
Josh?
I'm kind of flabbergasted that I discovered some Doctor Who terminology that I'd never heard before. And you guys might be aghast and know exactly what I'm talking about. But in doing a little bit of research on the Web of Fear for this episode, I came across this expression of a Yeti on the loo. Somehow in my in my years and years of Doctor Who nerddom, this totally missed me. And according to the internet, this is a common expression, and it comes from a Jon Pertwee quote.
Yep.
Describing Doctor Who's tendency to put monsters in mundane, everyday settings. And Jon Pertwee described it as, there's nothing more alarming than coming home and finding a Yeti on the loo in Tooting Beck.
The Tooting Beck part.
Tooting
really
Beck
sells
makes
that.
It, doesn't it? Because from an American point of view, Yeti on the loo, that's kind of funny. But Tooting Beck is hilarious. I love it. I love the idea of a Yeti on the loo.
I've never heard that either. And
okay, good.
Big hairy thing on the toilet. Yeah. I mean, that's right up my alley, you know?
It sounds like a folk song, like Pete Seeger would sing it. Oh, there's a Yeti on the loo in Tooting Beck.
If we ever record a CD of like nerd songs, we have to call it a Yeti on the loo.
Yeah, in the style of like early Steel Eye Span. Well, for the record, Josh, I'm well familiar with that expression.
See, yeah, I don't know how that missed me, but
I've never used it until tonight.
Well, I'm going to use it all the time, mainly with people who know nothing about Doctor Who, just to confuse the hell out of them.
Well, my temporal grace this week, I will be continuing to express my love for 1970s British television. Mm-hmm. My wife and I are rewatching one of our favorites, I, Claudius, from 1976. Mm-hmm. And it is full of past and present Doctor Who-related actors. You've got Derek Jacobi, John Hurt, Brian Blessed, but also, apropos of the Daleks Master Plan that we talked about last time, it's got Kevin Stoney, who played Mavic Chen.
Does he do I, Mavic Chen?
No, he's a much more comic character. He's a Greek fortune teller named Thrasyllus. It also has Fiona Walker, who played Kala in The Keys of Marinus, but we probably remember her more as Lady Painfort in Silver Nemesis.
Awesome.
It's got John Bennett, who played General Finch in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, which we talked about recently, and he is also Li Shen Chang in The Talons of Wang Chiang.
Oh, okay.
It's also got Stratford Johns from Kelvin's favorite Four to Doomsday.
It's an underrated story.
There's even a small role for the Jamaican actor Roy Stewart, who's recognizable as one of the few black faces around. He played Toberman in The Tomb of the Cybermen and also Tony in Terror of the Autons. And then, like, everyone else is recognizable nerd actors, too. There's Sean Phillips, who was in Dune, among a million other things. It's got Patrick Stewart, John Rhys-Davies, who played Sala in Raiders of the Lost Ark and was on Sliders and in Lord of the Rings, Gimli in Lord of the Rings. Simon McCorkindale. Yes, who was in the 1979 Quatermass TV movie, which I talked about on a recent podcast. But he's also Manimal.
He's Manimal,
of course.
Yeah. That's why I got excited.
You understand that I'm only scratching the surface of the actors here, too. Wow. I think I, Claudius, employed every working actor in Britain at the time. So it's just, it's independent of that it's one of the best written television programs ever created, it's also just a feast for Doctor Who nerds.
All right, and now round two, special topics, Dalek, in which I am going to dazzle these gentlemen with a special topic, a question that I want them to answer for me. And since we're talking about the Brigadier in these next series of podcasts, I found it kind of tragic that Nicholas Courtney didn't make an appearance in the new series before he sadly passed away. He showed up in the Sarah Jane Adventures. But I'm wondering if we could choose one of the new series doctors for Nicholas Courtney as the Brigadier to appear with.
That's a good question. You have the Brigadier's daughter, who's been interacting with Peter Capaldi.
Mm-hmm.
Did she interact with Matt Smith? Yeah. Yeah. She did, Matt, of course, very briefly. Day of the Doctor and even earlier. So I can see that being in the neighborhood of how they would get along, because Kate Lethbridge-Stewart is in the same neighborhood of how she portrays that role. So I think I'd rather go with Christopher Eccleston. His extremely abrasive attitude, and very abrasive in a different way than, say, John Pertwee was, would clash very strongly with the Brigadier. And I think it would be neat to see how this traumatized, PTSD-suffering doctor gets along with an extremely military-type figure, but also one of his oldest friends. Mm-hmm. I think that would be fun to see Christopher Eccleston, who's a very talented actor at playing nuance, try to navigate those different emotions that are going on inside of him.
See them, like, in a weird way, like the Ninth Doctor and the Brigadier getting on pretty well in a weird way, just because, like, the Ninth Doctor's, like, the big working-class doctor.
Yeah, I think finally the Doctor would make total sense to the Brigadier.
Yeah.
And I think it's almost more interesting from the Brigadier's point of view to meet the Ninth Doctor, because there are many, many podcasts where I steal your answer, Pat. You totally 100% stole mine. That's what I would have killed to see, because I think that would have been magical. I wouldn't want Tennant, because Tennant would just put him on a pedestal, and it would just be him fawning all over the Brigadier, which would be pretty boring.
Yeah, either the Ninth or the Eleventh.
Yeah, I think there would be some fun with the 11th Doctor in that he's so, the childlike quality. It would really feel like the Brigadier was babysitting him. And it was figurative in the John Pertwee situation, but it would be almost literal.
Well, I can see the 11th Doctor of the newer Doctors like being the one who's most cooperative with the UNIT and things.
And that's proven to be true, if I remember. The one time you see 9 with UNIT, well, they get killed by the Slitheen fairly quickly, so you don't see a lot of it, but he doesn't seem to think one way or another about them. But you do see Matt Smith interacting with UNIT a lot and being on call in a way that you hadn't seen since 4.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just feel like that was just a really missed opportunity not to have him in, even as a cameo. I know he was very infirm at the end of his age.
Yeah, he's in an episode of the Sarah Jane Adventures, but they don't do a lot of activity with him
because
he wasn't too mobile. I know they intended to have him at the Wedding of Sarah Jane episode in the Sarah Jane Adventures, but he was just too sick. And then you could have seen him interact with 9, because David Tennant is in that episode. You're right. I'm getting my numbers all day.
I didn't jump in there because I was expecting Josh to have like a seizure or something. And like it didn't happen.
I was going to let him dig his own grave. I wanted him to get all the angry letters.
I've been watching the show for 30 years, you guys. More than that, 35 years. And I can't remember the first thing about it.
We're not very mobile anymore either.
No. Okay, folks, now we're up to, of course, the randomizer, and we will be discussing the second Doctor story, The Web of Fear, which features the first ever appearance of Lethbridge Stewart when he was just a young, fresh-faced colonel.
I have a question for you guys.
Yeah.
Do you think that in these early scripts, Lethbridge is supposed to be his first name?
Hmm.
It's always bothered me because they don't actually give him his Alistair until later. He's always Colonel Lethbridge Stewart or Brigadier Lethbridge Stewart. And I don't think it is supposed to be his first name because here you're always talking about Captain Knight and Evans.
Yeah, I didn't
really
get that impression. I think that it was supposed to be his hyphenated last name.
Okay.
You know, I think they just really wanted to clearly portray that, you know, a tough old Scotsman military guy.
And as long as we're talking about Colonel Brigadier, I remember the first time before these episodes were discovered, listening to the audio of this, how disappointed I was to discover that the Doctor and the Brigadier meet off screen.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, we're going to finally see them meet for the first... Nope. They just walk on together. And yet, and after watching it again this time, there was something kind of cool about that. That they just, this almost implication that they're just perpetually known one another. And it could support your wife's headcanon. Mm-hmm. That
just got zapped in by the Time Lord.
Yeah. It's Brett Vion.
There could be some like weird mini-adventure where... There, you know, that happened during the middle of the Web of Fear, where the
there actually is a short story by Candy Jar
Publishing, the ambush
that does describe the ambush of the Colonel's vehicle and his first encounter of the Doctor. So the stuff that's not shown on screen, it has been at least done in prose form.
I was looking that up today because Candy Jar are the people that do the Lethbridge Stewart novels, mm-hmm. Many of which I bought for the Kindle and haven't gotten around to reading yet. But there's a new collection of short stories that mm-hmm. had appeared online or in Doctor Who magazine.
Yep, that are free.
But they're also being compiled into a book or an ebook, which is coming out in some months. And so I'll probably get around to reading these at some point.
I must confess I was unaware of this.
Yeah, for a while they had advertised a number of different people writing for the series, and I was really excited about Lance Parkin. Ooh, Lance Parkin's going to write one, but now his name has quietly vanished from this series. I assume they didn't come to some agreement on what they were going to do. But I don't know. I like the Brigadier a lot, and I'll read at least a few of these, assuming they're any good.
Well, watching this story again, I'm very curious about these novels and short stories, because it's very clear that Colonel Lethbridge Stewart was obviously not intended to be a recurring character.
Definitely
and almost
not.
None of his character traits are in place, because a lot of what he does in this episode is be a red herring.
Yeah, which they have a lot of play with. Who's mm-hmm. the pawn of the intelligence? I don't know if anybody really cares all that much.
No.
The show seems to care more than the viewers do, but they do a lot of that. Crawley is off stage for a big part of it, just to be, again, a red herring mm-hmm. to divert attention. He's a lot more like Brett Vion than he is the later Brigadier that we
know. I was kind of struck by the weird seriousness he takes the Doctor when the Doctor first starts describing the TARDIS. And was it Knight who's like, oh, come on, you can't possibly believe this nonsense. And it's like, well, I don't, but it's like the one option we have.
I'm Brett Vion and I've traveled in it.
Yeah.
I took that as you were supposed to, as the viewer, who at that time, watching it for the first time, didn't know he was going to become a recurring character, think, oh, he's not suspicious of a time machine. He must be a pawn mm-hmm. of the Yeti.
Oh, I didn't even think of it that way.
It's hard to
It's hard to decouple
that knowledge. Yeah,
it's hard to decouple like the decades of Doctor Who.
Yeah, even in his very next appearance in The Invasion, he's a gentler character. Mm-hmm. He's much friendlier, and he and the Doctor greet each other warmly, mm-hmm. as if they're old pals, although there's nothing to suggest that from what we see on screen between the two of them here.
Yeah. But, you know, as long as we're not talking about stereotypes, let's talk about stereotypes. Let's get that out of the way.
I'm kind of glad UNIT wound up not having a comedy relief Welshman.
Yeah.
Well, even before the Welshman, the horrific Jewish stereotype at the top.
God. Yeah, I forgot about that guy.
Julius Silverstein, who just greedy and concerned that he was ripped off for this Yeti. It's really egregious.
Yeah, you know, I kind of blocked that out. I just watched it a few days ago, and I had completely forgotten about
it.
I had to pick my jaw up.
I have to admit, like, some kind of weird hysterical blindness happened there, and I didn't pick up on the stereotype Jew-ness. God, this is kind of a terrible thing to say, but I was so taken with how gorgeous that first episode is.
Oh, yeah, mm-hmm. The direction is just beautiful.
I mean, it seems like a reasonably budgeted horror movie or something, and not just TV.
Yeah, and Douglas Camfield again. We talked about him in the previous episode.
Confession time. I did not actually have the opportunity to watch this with the recovered episodes. I thought I had access to that. I didn't, and I wound up watching it with like a really crappy restoration from
Amazon. Son, you can borrow it from me because it is gorgeous, and the quality of the recovered episodes, mm-hmm. just the condition that they're in.
Yeah.
Very, very good.
Because the one episode that had existed previously was just the first episode. So he has this what I think was a great first episode, and then it's just this non-moving nothing, and I'm like, oh, God.
Like we say about almost all the six-part Doctor Who episodes, it didn't need to be six parts. Mm-hmm. It really didn't have enough story for that, but it's directed with such panache mm-hmm. that it's really fun to watch. Mm-hmm. It's really just a mystery about who is the person who's under control of the great intelligence. It has some great character actors. I think Professor Travers is mm-hmm. so much fun. I love when he talks to the reporter. It's one of my favorite lines. When the reporter wants a comment, and he just goes, "It's unlikely we'll be able to defeat this menace. London, in fact, all of England might be wiped out." Thank you. It's like the worst soundbite ever.
It's like literally his way of just telling the reporter to go blow. You know, just yeah, like... Yeah.
And Anne Travers is great in this.
Anne is terrific. Do we want to say her great line there? Because the squad members are giving her trouble because she's a girl. And it's like, oh, so, you know, how did you become a scientist? I was like, well, when I was a little girl, I wanted to grow up to be a scientist. So I became a scientist.
That's like a clapping line. That's what that is.
It's awesome. It's a fantastic line, and it's honestly pretty amazing that it happened that early.
Well, we get the Brigadier showing up in this episode, but she's really like a proto Liz Shaw.
It's really nice to have her balance off Victoria. Now, I love Debbie Watfield, and oh, that cute little mini dress that she's got on is just, oh, that's so 60s. That's so great. Now, she's very likable, but she's basically useless.
The kindest thing the Doctor could do is just drop her off anywhere.
Yeah.
Anywhere. And just get her out of the TARDIS.
Victoria is sort of the... High point isn't the right word. The pinnacle of the companion who's just really scared a lot.
Yeah. The ne plus ultra of streamers.
Yeah, ne plus ultra, yes.
The producers really liked the Professor and Anne as mm-hmm. well. The Professor had been in The Abominable Snowman mm-hmm. A little bit earlier, and they had originally intended to bring them back again for the invasion, and that's why when the Doctor lands, they go to visit Anne, but she's on vacation or something, and they meet a character who is exactly like her, but is not actually the same person, and then they have an adventure with her.
The character is well written, but that actress is fantastic.
Yeah.
She's really appealing.
I know she appears in some of the Lethbridge Stewart books, so I'll report back for a Silence in the Library episode at some point in the future when I get around to reading those.
One thing that struck me watching this, and it's in the first episode, so Calvin saw it, is I love the scene in the TARDIS when the Second Doctor and Jamie are eating sandwiches and talking.
Yeah.
We're just eating
plain old sandwiches, yeah.
Is there any other Doctor-companion relationship that is that pally? They're like roommates.
Yeah.
And then and then Victoria comes in and they're like, oh, nice dress. Anyway, back to our sandwiches and our guy talk. It's just like so
awesome.
There's
a blinking light on the panel, Doctor. And like, oh, no, there's no blinking light on the panel. Sandwich.
They seem like buddies.
Yeah.
Like they it doesn't seem mm-hmm. like the Doctor is really far above Jamie.
Doesn't talk down to him. No. Never.
And then there's another funny moment between the Doctor and Jamie after the Great Intelligence has said that what they plan to do, the Doctor is going to wipe his mind and mm-hmm. he'll be like a newborn baby. And the Doctor tells Jamie, "You'll have to look after me until I grow up." And there is just something so innocent about that, and
you could
I really
be my dad.
I really want to see that story with Jamie and Victoria raising the Second Doctor. It struck me again in that particular moment. Patrick Troughton, to me, should have like Tom Baker status.
Yeah,
I just think he's phenomenal. How he can move from this childish innocence and goofiness and pulling funny faces to being deadly serious and threatening, and he's just always good.
I love him, even though he comes out with "you blithering Welsh imbecile" in the final few minutes of the episode.
Yeah, that's pretty striking. I mean, Evans is just horrible. You're saying all these great things about this episode, but he is... It's not just that it's insulting and small-minded. It's just tedious from even a comic point of view. Yeah. Let's say we all thought the Welsh were idiots. Yeah. Even by those standards, this guy gets so old that you're just like, please... please have a Yeti eat him.
Yeah, he's in too many episodes.
Yeah.
Frankly, if he'd come in a few later, we might have tolerated him. I have a question, though. Maybe our UK listeners could answer this.
Yeah.
All three of them.
If such a creature exists.
Do you hate the Welsh? Yeah, What's going on?
No, I mean, I have had trouble with this for a long time because I don't have the particular cultural context. I only know what I read on the internet, essentially. But, like, if you make jokes like this about the Welsh or the Scottish, like, what level of intolerance is this? Is this, like, me saying terrible things about black people, for example? Or is it more like, oh, it's regional humor? Like, if I said something about somebody from
Southerners,
Alabama
or
whatever, which might still be insulting and intolerant, but it doesn't rise to the level of what I would consider
racial,
deeply racist stuff.
Yeah, it's tough to say because it is, you know, an ethnic group.
Yeah. And a disadvantaged one historically,
and
all the legacy of colonialism and yada, yada, yada. But I just don't know, like, what your typical Welshman, for example, would think of that joke. Is it just like, oh, they're making fun of us again? Or is it like, I'm deeply offended because that's racist?
Tangent here, but I saw, like...
On a podcast, Colvin?
Yeah.
For God's sake.
I saw a Spike Milligan sketch once where it was a sketch about the Irish space program. Okay, now Spike Milligan is Irish, okay? So maybe he gets a pass here. But it's literally like it's an outhouse on top of a pile of dynamite. You know, the Irish are all, like, super lazy. And, like, it starts off with, like, the Spike Milligan character having to go into, like, the employment office. And his line is there any fear of work? And it's amazing, but it's just the most viciously insulting thing.
I think there's something, if you're doing a comedy sketch, there's a certain implication of irony. And maybe that doesn't exist there, and maybe it's because you hate the Irish. But when it's in a drama, it feels more hateful for some reason. I don't know why.
Yeah, well, and it's always context sensitive. Trying to recapture what the original audience would have thought. Well, and that's a losing game, too, because they're just... frankly more racist than television is these days, so I don't know.
Other people are much more racist than Americans are.
Well,
that was irony, podcast listeners. Yeah. We don't want any emails.
Can you put in like a little sound effect that says irony, like, you know, irony.
We'll have like a cloister bell for irony on the podcast. Like,
how can I rephrase what I just said so that it doesn't sound just flat out wrong? Television is less accepting of these racist stereotypes now. Whatever. Okay, we all know what we're talking about. We get enough of this.
We're all the same.
Yeah. I don't see race.
Moving along.
This is far from the most intolerant Doctor Who story. I don't know why we got off on this subject.
But I will say this on a more shallow note, the Yeti fight was awesome.
The Yeti fight was awesome. Douglas Camfield again, gentlemen.
Because the Yeti seemed actually threatening. These big, fluffy, cuddly fights.
Yeah, because my only real experience with the Yeti...
My own personal experience with the Yeti.
When I sat next to one on the bus. But
when I was at the Lamasery...
I went in the loo, and there he was.
Yeah! There's a lot of First and Second Doctor era stuff that I've never really seen. And literally my only other exposure to the Yeti was just the tiny bit they're in The Five Doctors. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in The Five Doctors, they're just sort of these roly-poly, goofy, dumb things, you know? And
you know, my wife Carrie loves the Yeti too, but she prefers the original Abominable Snowman version with their big old butts. They look like Barney or something walking around.
Like big Yeti.
They might break that loo if they're sitting on that. But, you know, that fight scene, it is great. It's very well directed and it serves a good narrative purpose too, because it raises the stakes pretty highly, and it kills off about half the cast. Yeah. Like, oh, we feel like we're maybe kind of on top of things now. We got a bunch of soldiers. They seem competent. Knight is a competent, decent dude.
Yeah.
And then they all die.
Yeah.
They all get killed in like 10 minutes. Holy cow. Now we're in trouble.
And that I remember listening to in the audio form, and it was just like a bunch of, you know, chaotic nonsense. So it was just great to actually see
that poor guy trying to climb over the fence as the Yeti dragged down, grab onto his legs and drag him down.
And there's this horrific shot of the Yeti just pulling back and smashing downward. You can just almost hear the guy's spine.
Dang, I wish I had gotten access to the.
I'll hook you up, boy.
Yeah. Oh.
So, final thoughts on The Web of Fear. I think it's really strong, very well directed. Could have been an episode shorter, but we can say that about all Doctor Who.
Really great fun to watch. aside from the just terrible stereotypes. And maybe it's just the double whammy of the two. You're right, Doctor Who has stereotypes in it, but that's a bit much. Other than that, two thumbs up, especially if you hate Jews and the Welsh. Irony. Since we've just been discussing the once lost but recently found story, Web of Fear, we thought it was the perfect time to present a once lost but recently found Get Off My World. Listeners will recall episode 25, Lumpy and Unpleasant, was missing a temporal grace round, but no longer. It was recently discovered, not in Nigeria like Web of Fear, but on Tony's flash drive. Still, we couldn't be happier. So, we proudly present Round 1 Temporal Grace from March 2016, featuring our special guest, the Reverend Matthew Kesson. Enjoy.
Today, we'll be talking about, well, a bunch of stuff. Should I go ahead and... What happens?
What happens?
I've never listened to your show.
Well, you're in good company.
It's not like The Tonight Show, where it just has this bulletproof format that anyone can just waltz in on.
Well, I think what'll happen next is our first round, which we like to call Temporal Grace.
Right.
This is where we go around the table and we each say something that we love about Doctor Who. So, as our guest, would you like to start today?
Sure, I can start. I have, in fact, listened to some of your show, and I've noticed that...
Liar!
I've noticed that Temporal Grace is often about, like, ancillary stuff. Stuff attached, stuff related to Doctor Who, or stuff spun off from it. And listening to that reminded me of, and, you know, stop me if someone's already done this, but my favorite thing that is connected to Doctor Who that is not, in fact... a Doctor Who episode, it was this thing that was this bit of fan art from a couple years ago by a guy called Bill Mudron, or Mudron, I don't know how it's pronounced, and he did basically a picture in the in a Japanese woodblock style called Musha A, which is about samurai, of Madame Vastra and Jenny fighting some old school Cybermen. But again, it's in this old style with like these three panels and these banners with their names on them in Japanese, and they're all in these sort of poses from Kabuki theater and all this sort of thing, and it's just very much in that style, and I think I've always loved it. It was for sale for a little while, but it had stopped being for sale by the time I became aware of it, and so I programmed eBay to tell me whenever anything that said Madame Vastra on it came up, and uh-oh, that was a mistake.
It's an interesting artwork, I'm sure.
But I've always loved that, and I've always wanted a reproduction of it, and just as a... It was done entirely as a fan thing, but then they were doing these things called the Brilliant Book every year, where it was these sort of yearbooks for Doctor Who, and they printed it in the Brilliant Book for 2012, and so it became canonized a little bit, and I just think it's a beautiful piece of artwork, and I think it's amazing.
Well, all right.
Beautiful pieces of artwork are generally beautiful.
Yeah.
Hence the name.
I feel positively about them, yes.
How about you, Josh?
My wife actually sprang a bit of Doctor Who trivia upon me that I had never heard before. I know, and she was so pleased. I think she thought at first that I was pretending to have never heard this fact, so I had to convince her that I'm really surprised by that. And so, obviously, any nerds listening to this might already know this, but I found out that one of my favorite British actors, Robson Green, from Touching Evil and Wire in the Blood, was approached by Russell T. Davies originally to play the new series Master, the first one that John Sims eventually played. And first of all, I was like, that would have been incredible. And then I remembered the scripts that poor John Sims got, and I went, maybe that's a great thing he turned it down. I also heard, I couldn't find the source material for this, and maybe it's from a writer's tale that Russell T. Davies wrote, but supposedly Robson Green made some somewhat derogatory comments about Doctor Who that made a lot of fans really angry about it being pantomime, and he didn't want to do it, but you know how easily angered Doctor Who fans are.
Well, but I'm getting angry right now.
I'm mainly excited for my wife that she was able to surprise me with some Doctor Who factoid.
Well, I want to, as my temporal grace, just do a quick shout-out to Robert Banks Stewart, who just died a short while ago.
Way to die, Robert.
Way to die, Robert Banks Stewart. January 14th of this year, he wrote two stories for Doctor Who. He wrote Terror of the Zygons and The Seeds of Doom, both of which are among my favorites.
Yes.
And I just rewatched Zygons the other day. There's some story that the reason that Terror of the Zygons was the last story released on DVD is because of some feud between Doctor Who personnel, where one person said, this was my favorite Doctor Who story ever, and the person in charge of the DVD releases then decided, well, that will be the last one that ever comes out on DVD. And I'll have to look up the provenance of this story, but it is true that for a story with the popularity of Terror of the Zygons, these DVDs started coming out in 2001, and the last one came out last year with the Underwater Menace still to come, but that was a late arrival because of the new missing episodes that they found. So Zygons was essentially the last of the normal ones to be released. So, but anyway, for whatever reason, that's why I just got around to rewatching it the other day, and it holds up. It's terrific. Robert Banks Stewart was a Scottish writer. He's
born. That explains the Scottishness.
Yes,
of the Zygons.
1931, he was born. He did a lot of stuff for television, including Danger Man and The Avengers.
Oh, cool.
And various other things that, you know, people would recognize. But for Doctor Who fans, he's recognized for Zygons and for Seeds of Doom, both of which I love. And he just died a short while ago, so I wanted to say thank you, Robert Banks Stewart, for writing those things that I love.
You need more three-named writers in the world. Okay, do you guys remember the Doctor Who pinball game?
Yes, there's one at the 19 bar.
Pat and his friend Tim regularly held this bar crawl every year. They used to stop at the 19, and then they stopped stopping at the 19, and I was upset about it because that meant I couldn't play the Doctor Who pinball game. But anyway, there is a company called Farsight Studios, and they are currently running a Kickstarter to digitize the Doctor Who pinball game. Yeah, we could have the Doctor Who pinball game as an app relatively shortly. And
that's wonderful.
Apparently they've done that before with some other pinball games, but they're going to try and do it with the Doctor Who one. And I was totally unaware of this, but apparently the Doctor Who pinball game is very well loved among pinball enthusiasts. It's considered like one of the best pinball games like ever. Like, it was just really well designed and clever and stuff.
Interesting.
Which I was totally unaware of. I just liked it because it was Doctor Who, you know?
I was so drunk when I was playing it. I couldn't tell you.
It's Sylvester McCoy.
Yeah.
He's got his umbrella.
Sylvester McCoy's actually on the pinball game. Whoa. I thought I was seeing triple, but no, it's just all seven doctors are right up there. But I don't know when this podcast is going to go out, but currently, as of this recording, they have 16 more days left on the Kickstarter.
And they've raised $2 million,
and,
right?
And they're about halfway there. Kind of.
So $4 million is their goal?
Yeah.
Gentlemen, it's time for our fifth and final round of the episode, The Death Zone. Mm. We haven't had one of these in a while.
No, really haven't.
Thank you for the ontological confirmation. You guys, Kelvin's getting strappy tonight.
Yeah. I had half a glass of wine, so you gotta be careful.
Our fifth and final round, the Death Zone, this time out will concern a battle royal, not a physical battle royal,
no.
But who do we like the most
of
all of the 60s era companions?
Wow.
So that's First and Second Doctor. And so that's Susan, Barbara, Ian, Vicky, Stephen, Katarina, Sarah Kingdom, maybe, Dodo, Polly, Ben, Jamie, Victoria, and Zoe.
I think the easiest way to approach this would be to kick some people out right away.
Probably.
I think we can pretty much throw Dodo.
Dodo gets thrown under the bus pretty quickly.
Yeah. Or are you going to stand up for Dodo, Pat? There is a moment of hesitation.
Well,
which you're going to be chivalrous.
Well, part of the problem is that a lot of Dodo's episodes don't exist. Celestial Toymaker, which doesn't have a great reputation as a Doctor Who story, it's missing three of the four parts. The Massacre, where she doesn't play herself, but the actress...
her ancestor.
Yeah, Jackie Lane plays the ancestor of Dodo. I remember her as being pretty good in that. But again, it's not Dodo. You're right. You know, I remember liking her in The Ark, but it's been a while since I've seen The Ark. Mm-hmm. So wow, you're right.
Yeah, if it took us this long to debate whether Dodo was on the list or not,
we were just
65 minute round
demonstrating our geek credentials.
Fair enough.
For like how much we know about Dodo, because who knows anything about Dodo?
Okay, well, if we're chopping people, and if we're going to be ruthless about this, then I am going to chop Susan.
I think Susan goes.
Susan was a very a big missed opportunity character.
Tragic, sad, but yes, she's not that
fascinating
good.
Concept. And I suppose Carol Ann Ford had the misfortune to be directed by all these old sexists who could conceive of nothing for her to do but twist her ankle and whine a lot. If we were expanding out into talking about novels and things, she's absolutely terrific in several novels, including one of my favorites, Kim Newman's Time and Relative, where she's the narrator. But if you gotta stick
she
to
comes back in some Eighth Doctor Big Finish audios, and she's really good. But yeah, in the televised series, no.
Yeah, no. So it's the 60s here. Is there anybody you want to cut, Kelvin?
I think I got to cut Victoria. She doesn't really do anything except scream and be scared of things.
She does a lot for the Second Doctor's character, his paternal care for her.
Sure.
It reveals something about the Doctor, but it does not do anything to make
you
like her.
I could really remember Victoria doing is this rather sexist moment where she gets hired to be a cook in the enemy of the
world. It's true. I mean, I think she's adorable. I think Victoria is just very cute and very likable, but I don't think she adds much to any story that she's in.
No.
At least of the ones I've seen. There's some I haven't.
Yeah. I would have to toss both Katarina and Sarah Kingdom off the list because I don't feel they are of...
I think
they're pseudo-companions.
Yeah, on a technicality, I agree with you.
Yeah, Katarina has to go. I have a weird soft spot for Sarah Kingdom as like a potentially missed opportunity, although there was never any consideration for her to really be an ongoing character.
But could she take the top spot of the 60s?
I don't think so.
Don't think so. No. She wasn't around enough.
All the rest of the ones, I genuinely like.
They're solid companions, in my opinion. So now it gets tricky.
I think we're going to say that Ben and Polly can't go the distance.
And I love Polly a lot.
I love Polly a lot.
Ben's easier to let go.
Well, I think they work together. I think they have to stay or go together. And I agree with you. I like them. These are all hard choices from here on out.
How much of this is actual critical assessment and how much of it is hormonal? But
if you're looking at them as a duo, they cannot compete with Barbara and Ian as a duo, in my mind.
Yeah.
So who are we left with? We've got Barbara, Ian, Vicky, Stephen, Jamie, and Zoe.
Let's create some Voltron-like companion of all those guys. We're down to, I think those are the best of the 60s.
Maybe,
right there.
Yeah. This is tough. I think I might have to say Vicky.
Yeah, I agree with you, but maybe not for the same reasons. My feeling about her, and I really like Vicky, she's a significant improvement on Susan, but she's essentially the same character.
Yeah, I mean, it's basically trying to do...
But done better.
It's basically trying to do Susan the way they should have done Susan.
But in that way, she still seems a little like
a little
shadow.
Like warmed over leftovers or something.
She's the last, well, she's not quite, but she's nearly the last gasp of the original family structure of the show, where you had the grandfather, the mother and father characters, and then the younger girl. Because Vicky overlaps with Ian and Barbara for a considerable length of time.
Yep.
And once she goes, then the Doctor's with Stephen. They immediately replace her with Katarina, who doesn't really work out. And then Sarah Kingdom's got her own thing. And now we're in uncharted territory. There's an episode with just the Doctor and Stephen, and then Dodo's back there, but Dodo doesn't last very long. Blah, 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 blah.
There's a lot of chaos in the first Doctor era.
Yeah, there is. In season three of in Hartnell season three, it all goes kind of bananas.
We have to get rid of Stephen.
Ooh, that's a tough one. I love his panda, the mascot. He goes back into the blowing up city to rescue the panda mascot, the stuffed animal. That's so charming.
I'm just going to cut some time here. If we're talking about the first Doctor, I'm going to jump ahead, and I'm going to say probably the best first Doctor companion is Barbara.
Damn it, Josh, my conclusion.
I'm going to make the case for that. I think as a standalone male companion, I think Stephen might just edge out Ian, I think he's a little more versatile and he stands alone, but I love them both. Hard to kick him off. But Barbara, there's just something amazing about that performance, and the writers seemed to really step up when it was Barbara. She had a couple emotional moments mm-hmm. and a couple embarrassing bits like all the companions do in this era, but mm-hmm. she was able to retain such strength while not being a hard ass or some cliche in the other direction either. She had this emotional strength that really paired well with William Hartnell's Doctor.
And they seemed to genuinely like each other. They had, the relationship between Barbara and the First Doctor is unusually warm, mm-hmm. And I think that's a reflection of how they actually felt about each other as actors, because I think Jacqueline Hill and also Carol Ann Ford and William Russell, as we know, got along with Bill Hartnell better than just about anyone
else. Oh, yes.
Well, I can't argue with that, and I mean, it would be hard for me to choose between Ian and Stephen. I'd probably go the reverse of you. I'd probably go with Ian, but I agree that Barbara, between the three of them, we'll just skip ahead and say that Barbara is the one.
And so that leaves us with Jamie and Zoe.
I would just have to cut Zoe out of that immediately. That's a huge loss, but mm-hmm. I think for emotional depth, Barbara's just got it all over her.
Yeah, and I mean, then you leave Jamie there, and Jamie's hard because I honestly believe there's no other companion relationship like Jamie's in the second
Doctor. Jamie's the male companion. I mean, he just is. I mean,
and it's hard to think of the First Doctor and Barbara just going around together.
Yeah.
You know, Ian has to be there. Somebody like Susan has to be there.
Yeah, you see, that's the thing. Ian and Barbara are such a duo that I can't separate them, really.
Yeah, but do we need to? Just for purposes of who our favorite 60s era companion is, like, who do we genuinely love watching the most? Look, interactions with the Doctor. Who?
Well, for me, it's always Jamie, but I don't.
Oh, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Barbara on this one, I think. Mm-hmm. I there's such a warmth there that I really, really like. And that has to be Barbara and Ian, I guess, for me. So that just kind of comes in as part of the package.
Yeah. And I mean, if I'm talking about the Doctor and the companion, I love the Second Doctor and Jamie together. Mm-hmm. But Barbara performs that function of sort of elevating the character of the First Doctor. She really augments his character in a way that Jamie sort of talks him down from
when he's like super crabby. And
well, this I is mean, if I could if I could do a tie, I would do a tie between Barbara.
But and, this is the death zone, and you are the tiebreaker
you
here.
Son of a.
Mm-hmm. Who's it gonna be? Who dies? Josh, kill your darlings.
I'm gonna go with Barbara.
Wow. Okay.
Just barely.
You're still mad about Kelvin's Dick Van Dyke.
I am. Doesn't matter how many podcasts ago.
Yeah, sandbagged you, Kelvin. This is the death zone. 12 or so companions enter, one companion leaves.
The greatest companion of the 60s, according to this podcast, Get Off My World, is Barbara.
That's right. Heard it here first.
Minority opinion.
Shut up, Kelvin.
I still have representation as a minority government.
This isn't Parliament.
Okay, Whovians, that about wraps it up for another edition of Get Off My World. Next time, we are going to be continuing our arc discussing the Brigadier with the Third Doctor story, Terror of the Autons. And we also be getting into the next Eighth Doctor story that has just been released, Doom Coalition 2 on audio from Big Finish.
More Paul McGann.
With Riversong.
Riversong is in this one, yeah. That's gonna
our
be
favorite.
Okay, so, until next time, this is Kelvin.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Pat.
And we're saying, get off my world! I know he was in World War II, and he wrote an autobiographical book about his experiences in the army, and it has the greatest title. It's called Hitler, My Part in His Downfall. Spike Milligan was just one of those guys who was so weirdly effortlessly funny. I just don't even...
I should really dig into more. I've only heard a
you
little...
You have to read Pakun sometime.
Pakun?
He wrote a comic novel called Pakun. It's about an Irish village called Pakun that is built like... It's like set in when Ireland gets split into
In the partition
and
Pakun is like right on the border.
Okay.
And there's like some weird thing where like the Catholic graveyard is on the wrong side of the line, so they're trying to like move bodies. Why did I never know of this?
This is exactly the sort of thing I would want to read.
It's this wildly absurdist novel, and there's this hysterically long passage, and I'm sure I've mentioned it before because it ties in with so many of my other comedic fascinations. But it's about some... It's some weird digression about, like, some Irish lord who builds the ultimate bathroom.
Okay, I just ordered it.
Because he... And it's like this, like, just Taj Mahal bathroom... And with all these appliances, it's literally like 10 pages just describing this bathroom. And like one segment is like, there's next to the toilet, there's an assortment of fowling pieces on a rack. So he can like take rifles and lean out the window and shoot grouse while he's on the toilet. it's like this weird 10 page aside and it all comes around to like, a weird callback joke, and I'm just like, my God, who writes this stuff?
Well, Calvin, that'd be great for our Spike Mulligan podcast.
What else do we have? We have one more round, right?
We do. We got to talk about, I don't know, something. Some nonsense, I don't know.
Let's do it. That's good, done.
And you don't realize he's talking Calvin? About a bathroom for a while because he uses, like, the some kind of weird... French euphemism for bathroom or something? Like,
there was a phrase we used to throw around in the no pants days. It was this: we've lost Calvin.
I would get on some laughing jag about some stupid ass thing
and
not ever get
we
off.
Might need to adopt that again. This podcast.